Let's run it. It's Hot Sheet from Baseball America. We are excited that we're going to talk to Ryan Waldschmidt, who's the D-backs minor league player of the year, according to Baseball America. He's going to join us soon, but we got a topic to hit before that. And before that segment, JJ, I just want to shout out the Baseball America Prospect Handbook, the 2026 edition, available at the baseballamerica.com shop. And it looks nice. Give us the goods. You're touching it.
So this is the 25, obviously. The 26 is not done. If the 26 is done, then we've gone through a time warp, because I know I have a whole lot of reporting left to do. So do a lot of other guys. But the 26 Prospect Handbook is where we compile all the work we've done over the past year of reporting, analysis, data, to rank the top 30 prospects in all 30 organizations. We do scouting tools grades on all tools for all 30 players, BA grades, which we've updated a little bit this year. So if you want to know everything about your organization, the handbook is what you need.
There you go. And where do they get it?
BaseballAmerica.com/store.
Boom. There you go. So please check that out. Support BA. Tons of hard work behind the scenes going on to put together everything team by team, which we're going to start with right now. Let's hit a prospect profile. Let's get into the farm system grade for the Diamondbacks. Jeff, you want to kick this off?
Yeah, sure. You know, a farm system that I think in some ways is on the upswing. I think you look at some of the deals that they made over the trade deadline, they were able to add some talent, particularly on the pitching side, which I think outside of a big breakout this year in Daniel Egan had been sort of lacking. You know, they also still have the sting of the Drew Jones pick, number two overall in that draft. And at this point does not look like he's going to ever be an everyday major leaguer. Obviously things are always subject to change, but at this point, that's kind of what the evaluations are throughout the industry. But I do think there is some positive here. We talked about Ryan Waldschmidt, Slade Caldwell also being a breakout. But the guys I want to focus on are three different pitchers that they acquired at the deadline. You know, I think probably the frontline name here is probably Cole Drake, just because he was an upper minors performer, probably had the biggest track record of success as a professional, was a guy that, you know, kind of came from humble beginnings and not necessarily a lot of pedigree in that Rangers farm system, and kind of worked his way into sort of the 40-man picture or the active roster picture kind of coming into this trade deadline. You know, they end up making the move for Merrill Kelly. Whether you think that works out or not, obviously they don't make the playoffs, so you can kind of maybe lean on the side that it didn't. It also kind of hurt some of the Rangers upper minors pitching depth, which is an area where I do think the system is still lacking for them. The Diamondbacks were able to acquire Drake. He's a guy that I think you can look forward to in a year and say, maybe he doesn't break camp with the team, but is going to be in the rotation picture in one way, shape, or form. He's more of like a number four, number five sort of starter upside. I think it's the same for other left-hander they acquired from the Rangers and Mitch Brott. The guy that I do want to hone in on a little bit is David Hageman. Hageman's stuff is awesome. You know, a guy that was injured in college, you know, at the end of his college career, has, you know, an elbow surgery, comes back sort of midpoint through this year. They were holding him back from throwing this really nasty curveball that he throws. Once he was acquired, he'd just kind of come back into games. Once he was acquired by the Diamondbacks and they send him up to High A Hillsboro, he unleashes that curveball. And the numbers since that point kind of spoke for themselves. You know, just in terms of performance numbers, strikeout numbers, swing and miss for that pitch and against the fastball, but also the stuff plus numbers that we were seeing kind of across his arsenal. I think he's a guy that has potential number three upside. It's just when we sort of grade out these things and maybe say he is a 60 BA grade, he's somebody that has higher risk. So it's either a high to maybe even extreme risk profile, just based on the checkered injury history. But I do think that they did pretty well at the deadline in terms of bringing in some pitching talent, which is an area that they were deficient.
I'm going to jump on. So I'm kind of the Debbie Downer of this, because I'm going to bring up some of the things that are kind of concerns we saw this year. One is really disappointing, which is that Demetrio Crisantes, second baseman, had his second significant injury in his basically last 5 years. And so we really didn't get to see Crisantes on the field. We hope to see him back in 2026. But that's obviously something that happens, but you really, you hate to see it, because he's one of the better pure hitters in the system. But the big question that we are still going to be looking to find the answer for, and hopefully have an answer in 2026, is where is Jordan Lawler in these plans? He was going to be the shortstop of the future. That's obviously no longer the case. The Diamondbacks are good there. They've got one of the best shortstops in baseball at this point in Geraldo Perdomo. But where does Lawler fit now? He's had a lot of injury issues. He's kind of done everything that you can do at this point at the minor league level. But what we haven't seen yet is him take that over, carry that over to the major league level. He didn't get a whole lot of runway there with the D-backs this season. Again, he did have injuries. But I do think that that's kind of one of the key questions, the key to-do items going into 2026 is Jordan Lawler the third baseman of the future? Is he somewhere, you know, bouncing around?
Yeah, and to follow up on too, when you're talking about Jordan Lawler specifically, I mean, Torey Lovullo had him play DH for later half of this month just because he couldn't figure it out defensively. And I think that's another important metric too that we have to be able to analyze too, because I mean, coming into it before all the trade happens with Suarez getting dealt and all that stuff, there was really no place for him to go. Now that that place is there, I mean, it just seems to not be able to come up. And like you mentioned, being able to come up to that production on that side. But another D-backs infield prospect that I kind of want to talk about too, that maybe hasn't been, you know, on the radar as much, but I really want to talk about Tommy Troy and kind of, you know, their first rounder for a couple of years ago that just wasn't, you know, producing to the level that they had wanted, especially from a pedigree from a pick so high. He really took a really big step forward this year for the organization. I know he made it up to AAA. There was a lot better plate discipline. He wasn't chasing as much. And I think he's going to be a dark horse guy coming out of camp next year that I think could potentially, you know, fight for a position on the opening day roster. I think it's another player to keep an eye on, especially as we continue to monitor the struggles that Lawler's been able to present. What position Troy will play, whether it's going to be the infield or they do that shift to the outfield, it's going to be up to them when that decision ultimately looms come out.
So what does this all mean? Well, I think you could kind of add this up. We've got the D-backs as what their farm system grade for this year is a C. There's been some steps forward. There's been some injuries. There's been some steps back. It's not the best farm system in baseball. It's obviously not also the worst. It's kind of in that middle pack. Feel pretty good about a C. Now the question is going to be, like, this is a team obviously not that long ago was basically in the World Series. But at the same time, NL West is very difficult. And I can't say that they have the system where you say, oh, this is the team to beat in 27 or 28, because we obviously know that there's a couple of other teams, especially one that just seems to win the division year in and year out.
Yeah, I think that's what's frustrating for a Diamondbacks fan, or really a fan of any team in the National League West besides the Dodgers, JJ, is that fans look at the team and say, I get it. They spend more than everyone else, but how do they keep winning farm system wise when they pick towards the back half of the draft? They have less money to spend usually in the draft. A lot of things have been leveled in our sport in terms of those advantages that used to exist years ago. You know, you have a certain amount of money that you can spend on the amateur draft, on the international signings. So I think for a Diamondbacks fan, you're looking at the division saying, how do we get to the level of the Dodgers with our farm system? Forget the money spending situation.
So the toughest part of that is that one of the things that money also gives you is you don't have to be scared. You know, if for a lot of teams, if you make a wrong turn, make a wrong decision in one aspect of player development, sports science, analytics, whatever it is, it may set you back because you have limited resources. The Dodgers are the team that doesn't have limited resources. When I'm looking at these metrics that I kind of really kind of use in the minor leagues, we got a piece up at Baseball America today about walk rate for hitters in the minor leagues, right? And I kind of just look at that as obviously there's skill there. Obviously there's self-selecting of what teams are picking in the draft and internationally. But I do think that there's a lot of instruction to that. And look who's at the top in walk rate for hitters. It's the Dodgers. You know, look who's at the bottom in walk rate for hitters. It's the Rockies. It's something where these aren't surprising to find out when you look at it, because the D-backs, they do a good job. But the Dodgers are really an organization that is hard to try to keep up with, because it's not just spending money on free agents. It's spending money on sports science and on the best coaches and on the best technology and all these aspects of the game that they can, again, they can just be a little bit more aggressive because they're not as limited resource-wise as most everyone else.
Yeah, and I can't speak to this with any certainty on the Diamondbacks, but you know, I think the other thing that we've seen is the teams that do the best in the acquisition periods, particularly on the amateur side, whether that be international market, whether that be the draft, the teams that have a good balance of analytics and scouting, and then they have sort of a top-down philosophy that really is communicated at a high level across all different departments. So you have some synergy between scouting and the acquisition departments and the player development folks, and that could be on pro or on the amateur side. I think, you know, the thing that the Dodgers, the Mariners, the Rays, some of these teams that consistently are able to have good farm systems and competitive teams is they're able to find a good balance of that and make the most out of their opportunities, whether that be draft choices, whether that be bonus pool money in the draft, whether that be bonus pool money internationally. Obviously, the Dodgers are a different animal because they have, you know, so many resources and they are a very desirable place to go. But I think some of that is also earned based upon what they've done from a player development perspective and standpoint, that if you're a player and you're looking at a difference of $150,000 in signing bonuses, you may take less money to go with the Dodgers because of what it may pay off in the long run. So I think when we look at some of those advantages, those are the kind of things that a team like the Diamondbacks, they really need to make the most out of their picks, just getting the right talent into the organization, but also getting in guys that they feel their player development group can do wonders or just really work well with. And I think that's something that the Mariners in particular, who don't operate with a massive scale budget, have done a really good job of. And that's why they have the pitching staff that they have, and they have the pieces in the farm system that allow them to go out and reinforce this team. And I think now kind of enter the playoffs, at least based on Vegas's numbers, as the front runner in the American League.
And on the Diamondback side, we're expecting to talk to Ryan Waldschmidt soon. But when we swing back, let's spend a few minutes on the postseason and the impact that pitchers who spent a good chunk of time in the minor leagues can make now in October in the big leagues. That's coming up. AJ, let's talk stakes. Omaha Stakes, to be precise. Big, big discounts we'll tell you about coming up in just a sec on the website, but also every steak is perfectly aged to maximize tenderness and hand-cut by master butchers in America's heartland. It's been around since 1917. They know what they're doing.
Absolutely, they know what they're doing. They come prepackaged, perfect sizes, portion size. You can get any kind of cut you want, any kind of meat you want, and it all comes out delicious. You can freeze it. You can thaw it right away. There's hamburgers, there's steaks, there's chicken, there's pork chops, there's everything you could ever want, and it comes out delicious every time.
Save big with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and an extra 20% off select favorites during their early Black Friday sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code FOUL at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's 50% off at omahasteaks.com. Promo code FOUL at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details.
Getting the right people in the door quick is critical to maintain your company's workflow. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire fast. With Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring so fast because it puts the best and most qualified candidates in front of you quickly. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Back, and we're talking Diamondbacks today, and that means a conversation with Ryan Waldschmidt, 2025 Diamondbacks Minor League Player of the Year from Baseball America. Ryan, great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us. And how would you summarize the season that you just had?
Yeah, thank you for having me. First off, I appreciate it. But this year, I thought it was a great year all around. I think to be able to have a healthy full season is just awesome for anyone, and just anytime you go out there and play, that's the main goal, is to stay healthy. And I think I found a way to kind of enhance my abilities all around. I think I took little things in each aspect of my game, and that helped me kind of take a jump forward this year. And I also just am appreciative of all the teammates and all the coaches that I went through this year and had to be a part of with teams. And I appreciate everything that they did for me. And it was just an awesome year.
Hey, Ryan, thank you for joining us. To kind of take you back to, so fans who may not know your full story, could you kind of take us back? So coming out of high school in Florida, you were one of the better players at high school, but there's a lot of great players at high school. What was your recruiting process like? And could you kind of explain the process from high school to how you ended up at Kentucky eventually? And, you know, obviously kind of breaking out there after breaking out at Charleston Southern too.
Yeah, for sure. In high school, you know, I actually was a catcher my freshman year of high school. Just the varsity team needed a catcher, and I was like, yeah, I can do it. I'd like to think I'm a pretty utility kind of guy, like especially growing up. But, yeah, they were like, we need a catcher. And I was like, yeah, for sure, I can do that. I ended my freshman year actually getting ran over at the plate and breaking my elbow. So I missed my entire freshman summer into my sophomore fall. I came back in like the middle of the spring in my sophomore year. And that was kind of like the big recruiting time for, you know, high schoolers, is that freshman summer. I had some buzz with some Power 5 schools early on, but I kind of dropped off the radar after that injury and went into my sophomore year. And I was coming back off injury, so, you know, I was kind of on the smaller side. It just wasn't as strong or fast as some of the other guys my age. And that's kind of what they told me. Like, we want you to see you get stronger, faster. We like your skill set. We think you can play here, but we just want to see that happen before we make any calls on that. So I did that. I went into the gym. I ended up putting on like 20, 25 pounds. I was pushing 200 pounds going into my junior year. And I looked the part for sure. But that's when COVID hit. So still, I had no offers. Zero offers going into my senior fall, junior summer. And a coach that used to work at Ole Miss, Coach Mac, Mark McMillan, he gave me a call one day saying he was the head coach at Charleston Southern University and offered me a spot there. And, you know, I took that on the spot. Like, I just wanted a place to play and give me a chance to kind of show my abilities. So I went into Charleston Southern as an infielder. I played at some third base, some second base, and then I went into the transfer portal after my freshman year. I ended up playing half the year in the outfield after an injury we had to our center fielder. But that was the first time I've ever played the outfield. So I've always had that thought that I'd probably end up being an outfielder if I were to make it into the minor leagues and into the major leagues. And it kind of was the start of my outfield career. And I went into the transfer portal. I got a bunch of calls from a lot of schools. And I think the biggest thing was – where they wanted me to play. Half the time they wanted me to be an infielder, the other half they wanted me to be an outfielder. So I thought Kentucky was a great fit. I love the coaching staff. I love the facilities, and obviously it's the SEC, so if you perform in that conference, you have a really good chance of making that next step come true. So for me, all those things kind of aligned, and I didn't really take much time in the transfer portal. I thought Kentucky was a great fit for me. And they also wanted me to be an outfielder, which I thought was the next step in my career. So I took that, and then everything kind of took off from there.
Yeah, let's go back to that too, because you sort of, you know, you're going into your junior year. You had a few games here on the Cape with Katuit, but you were still kind of on the outside of like our top 100. I think it was outside the top 150. We started to hear some buzz from area scouts and cross checkers that you're blowing up athletic testing. And I think, you know, you went into your junior year, performed really, really well and raised your profile. When did you sort of start to hear from your agent and just maybe from other, you know, area scouts, folks in the industry that, you know, being a first round pick was, you know, a legitimate thing that could happen for you? So sort of when did that all start to come together? Because obviously, you know, you go into the portal, you go to Kentucky, profile still wasn't, you know, really high, but, you know, by the end of that junior year, you were considered, you know, consensus, like top 40 player in the class.
Yeah, you know, I got a couple games in the Cape and then ended up tearing my ACL. So I like just like my high school recruiting process, I like to think of it as pretty similar. You know, I had a very good chance to put myself in a great spot with a summer circuit, whether it was in high school or whether it ended up being in college in the Cape. But, you know, they both got cut short because of injuries. So I kind of felt like history was repeating itself there a little bit. And that was a big chance for me to take those strides and really kind of cement myself as a top player in the class. And it kind of got taken away from me pretty early. So, you know, it was very frustrating in the beginning. You know, you hate to have anything like that happen when you have a really awesome opportunity in front of you. But for me, it was kind of snapping out of that and just doing what I could to better myself in the next couple months and leading up to the season, because I knew my junior year was the year that I needed to put it all together to make myself become a first round pick that I ended up being. But it was more of whatever I could do in rehab and kind of staying positive and just kind of looking forward to the season, because I knew I needed to play. And I really came back quick from that ACL injury. I think I came back in about 7.5 months, I think it was. And, you know, that's kind of pushing it on the side of an ACL. I remember Doc telling me, like, hey, man, you blew all the physical testing away. Like, you're physically ready to go, but there's re-tear. Just caution, you know, you have, I think he said it was like a 33% chance that I re-tore it if I came back to play. But for me, it was, I needed to play. I needed to get out there on the field and I needed to showcase myself. And, you know, I kind of switched that mindset of playing now. You know, always growing up my whole life, it was kind of like to prove to everyone that I was good enough. Like, I belong here. I'm supposed to be here. Like, I deserve to be playing at this level. And once I got injured, before that, it was always about results. Like, I did everything to play well and showcase that I'm good enough. But once I came back from injury, I kind of just realized the joy of playing again, and you know how it could be taken away from you in an instant. So for me, it was all about just kind of going out there and having fun again. And I think when I did that and kind of dropped that burden of success, my results really took off. And I think that was something I took into this year as well. You know, it's a long season. It's a grind. But you got to find a way to enjoy it. And, you know, everyone loves playing baseball. That's what you do, and that's as our jobs, and we love that. But, you know, there's times when you're not doing the best. You're struggling. And it's very easy to kind of get down on yourself and get hung up there, and then next thing you know, a month goes by and you're still struggling. But for me, I think the biggest thing was kind of just being grateful to be out there and playing the game. And every day I was able to flush a 4-for-4 or even an 0-for-4. You know, you can flush it and just move on because, again, you get to wake up and you get to play the game again the next day. And I think that's really what helped me take off my junior year, is kind of that mindset. And honestly, when I started finding out I was close to being a first-round pick was just towards the end of the season. You know, I kind of tried to stay off of social media and stay away from looking at all the rankings and where I was put, because honestly, my goal was just to be on the field. And I kind of felt like I was playing with house money, just being able to be out there with the guys and play the last season of my college career. And, you know, by the end of the season, I looked back and I was like, man, these past 12 months have been an absolute roller coaster. But, you know, I was super grateful to be in that position I ended up being in.
Hey, Ryan. Yeah, Jesus Cano with Baseball America here. You talked about the importance of having a full, healthy season. You were able to do that in your first professional season with everything that happened. I want to hear from you kind of what was the adjustment, you know, going from playing college baseball to playing the pro ball? You know, how much different was it compared to college? And then just when did you feel exactly, did you feel like you were exactly comfortable playing professional baseball?
Yeah, you know, obviously, I think last season, not this past season I just played, but right after the draft, I got to head out to Visalia and kind of get a feel of what the professional week looks like. You know, I played 2 weeks there, and, you know, it's kind of, I feel like it all boils down to just knowing yourself, like what you need to be ready for the game. I think there's a lot of people that go out there and they take hundreds of swings before a game, and at that point, you're tiring yourself out for when the game comes. And maybe not on Monday night you feel that way, or Tuesday night, my bad, but you're going to feel that on Thursday or Friday because you've just used everything you've had in the tank. And I think that for me, it was kind of knowing what it takes to be ready for the game. And obviously different days take different amounts of preparation. But, you know, if there's a day you're really feeling good and you get in the cage and you hit a couple balls and your swing feels dialed, your mindset's right, like you really don't need any more. I think it's time times like that where you can just kind of save your energy a little bit and kind of just push through that and get ready for the game. And I think that was really what helped me throughout the year and being able to play as many games as I did. I think I ended up playing 134 in the regular season, and then we had two playoff games. So I think I ended at 136. But I think that was the biggest thing for me, was kind of knowing myself and knowing my body and what it takes to get ready. And I you know, that's the different aspect, I'd say, between college and professional, is kind of, it's all individualized. I think college, you have a lot of times where you have in and out before the game, or you have team BP before the game, or you have some pickoffs or base running. You have a lot of things that the team does together, and they make sure that everyone's doing that. But I think in the minor leagues, it's kind of whatever you feel like you need to do before the game, you can figure that out, and then you stay on that routine, and you kind of continue that cycle day by day.
Ryan, that was a really good answer. Really good answer. Really good stuff. Really appreciate the insight, and congrats on a great year too with the Diamondbacks. Thanks for joining us, man. This was great. Hope you enjoyed it, and good luck in the offseason. I'm sure we'll talk to you.
Of course. Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys.
Thank you, Ryan Waldschmidt. Great conversation with the Diamondbacks Minor League Player of the Year on Baseball America's list. If you want to see the winners per organization, of course, baseballamerica.com is the spot. One more quickie break. Then we get two rookie postseason pitchers and their impact. Okay, AJ, our slab pack ripping continues now. You just ripped a card that I think you're actually going to keep.
I am. I'm going to keep it. It's a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card. The old, isn't this the famous Upper Deck one? I believe it is. And yeah, heck yeah, I'm going to keep it because I'm going to get Griffey to sign it. I'm going to get him to send it to me, which you can do, and I'm going to get Griffey to sign it, and it's only going to make it worth more. So I am all in on this card. I am keeping it, and it is one of the coolest cards with the highest turtleneck you've ever seen and the gold chain around his neck.
Graded 9, 1989, Upper Deck. You get the offer for 179. It's valued at around 199. And you're like, nah, I'm keeping it. But if you wanted to sell it back instantly, you can. It's the beauty of Arena Club. AJ is going to send in and get the physical card sent to him. And you can do the same. 20% off your first slab pack or card purchase can happen for you if you go to arenaclub.com/foul and use the code FOUL. Hey, we're back. And I thought this was cool from Keegan Matheson, who covers the Blue Jays. He said their handling of Trey Savage this season is going to be used as the dream model by other teams and fan bases over the next few years. Player development moved him aggressively and left enough in the tank for the playoffs. I added that part. Savage nailed his side of it perfectly, played all of it. Jeff, do you agree?
Yeah, I do. And I think this was very intentional from the beginning of the season, just in terms of how they rolled him out and really their big arms, whether it was him or Steven, or even Stanifer, kind of, you know, ascended up to this conversation during the year. All of these guys were held back in Dunedin, where they knew they were going to deal with the best possible weather early on in the year. But also they have a great facility down there in Dunedin where their spring training home is. They have access to a lot of different coaching and technology, et cetera, to kind of make sure they were monitoring workloads. They piggybacked him and Stanifer, and then, you know, slowly, progressively moved him throughout each of these levels and exposed him to sort of enough innings to keep some in the tank while also, you know, allowing him to be challenged with some of these battles and facing the second time through the order every so often. So I think if you look back on, you know, each one of these starts, how many innings he went, how many pitches he went, they were really, really deliberate about that. And I don't think that is by accident, you know, with Justin Lear, Ricky Meinhold, and really a new pitching group there in Toronto. They've done a phenomenal job, not just with Savage, but I think with a lot of the arms that had the talent, but not necessarily the direction in previous years. And we've started to see that, and they did a phenomenal job with Savage, you know, pitched obviously big innings for him this weekend and helped him win the division for the first time in over a decade.
Hey, we love doing this show talking prospects, and then to get to see them in October is really cool. Jackson Jobe had his ups and downs last year in October. I know he's hurt this year now, but Chase Burns, Peyton Tolley, you've got also early for Boston, a lot of rookies that we're going to be able to see over the next several days. Enjoy postseason ball. We're still back here as usual every single week, Mondays on Hot Sheet. We'll see you for the next one.